Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, community-based intranet station broadcasting from Martinsburg, West Virginia, Hagerstown, Maryland, and Bolivar, West Virginia. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stacy Okelski.
And today is Monday, May 1st. Happy May Day, world.
happy May Day. Mayufka.
Oh, I have to write that down. That's a word I want to know. Mayufka?
M-A-J-O-F-K-A, I think.
Mayufka. And
Mayufka, it's Polish. Mayufka is a celebration of May Day. When I was in elementary school, of course, there's a Polish neighborhood. All the nuns were Polish. And every year we would go to Gwinnett Park in Baltimore.
Oh.
And we would get, tickets to ride the rides all day long. The nuns would go. We would get there on our own. It wouldn't be a bus or anything. We would get there on our own. Parents would take us in. But the fun of that day was the nuns. The first time I went, it dawned on me that this was a wonderful thing for the nuns because they could see the kids having fun and not having to worry about spelling and stuff like that, and the nuns really did. I mean, not every nun in the school went, but the nuns, each nun with their own class would meet kids and stuff. And we didn't have to do anything. You know, they weren't going to tell us what to do and go to, but they would just walk around and they would really, I remember being so impressed, even as a young kid, thinking, wow, the sisters are having such a good time enjoying us on the rides. And some of the nuns would get on a ride once in a while.
Wow.
Usually it'd be either one of the older nuns who, you know, would laugh at the ones who didn't want to do it, or the younger ones, the younger nuns, you know. But it was always a great day, you know. We would look forward to it so much. And it didn't always happen on May 1st because of the calendar, you know, sometimes. But it was a yearly thing. And I feel bad for the kids nowadays because they don't have something like that. I know they take them places to do stuff, you know, and trips and all that stuff. But Mayufka was a very special thing, you know, and it was celebrated by everybody, you know, families and sometimes the moms got stuck with bringing the kids because dads had to work. And when I was a kid, there were very few moms working. In at least in my neighborhood that I don't, you know, there were no dads staying home. So anyway, it was a great day. So
it sounds wonderful.
And I think we've been in 3 minutes already.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
It's been sort of a chaotic day. I mentioned I was on the phone with my brother just before the radio show. And of course, my sense of time is completely disarrayed. But I do want to thank Andy Offit Irwin for opening our show this morning with his original composition, Tarry Here. But I'm laughing because this morning, Jose, my husband, suggested that we have Randy Newman open the show with Baltimore, his song.
Who's Randy Newman?
Oh my gosh. All right. I'll have to find that song and send it to you. He's a quirky, very creative and talented singer-songwriter. I love him a lot, with a distinctive voice. A lot of quirky songs.
And he's from Baltimore?
I don't know if he's from Baltimore. I think he's an East Coast guy, but I don't know where he grew up.
Okay, well, Randy Newman in Baltimore. I have to look that up.
Okay, sounds good. So you want to talk about Speak, and I will talk
just
about
stories bit.
Around
okay.
a bit
Coming
later.
Up, May 9th and 10th, Andrew Agapor, storyteller and scholar of religion. And he was born in Charleston, South Carolina, raised in Charleston, South Carolina, by a Muslim Iranian father and a Christian British mother. It's very interesting background. So, humorous, mundane moments in life that are actually endowed with cosmic significance. That sounds so cool. It sounds like, and when I read that the first time, I read it a couple of weeks ago, I thought, yeah, it sounds like what happens to a kid when he's trying to pay attention in a Catholic school, but he doesn't believe half of what he's hearing. and the nuns are telling him strange stories about devils going around with pitchforks and stuff. Anyway, I thought, I hope this guy's got a good couple of good stories. And
sounds
that's going
like-
to be, yeah, it's going to be at the Marinoff this month. We're going to be at the Marinoff Theater on the campus of Shepherd University, May 9th and 10th, in person, 7:30 in the evening. And on May 9th, it will be also a Zoom presentation. So you can go to speakstoryseries.com and get the information, all the information you need, how to donate, if you want to donate to our cause, if you want to get a season ticket, or if you just want to get a one-time ticket. And then I'm just going to mention this, in June 13th and 14th, Reverend Robert Jones, an inspirational singer, storyteller, instrumentalist, and visual artist. And I'm looking forward to seeing Reverend Robert Jones. So there you go.
All right. I've not heard Andrew Agapor, but I have heard Robert Jones and enjoyed his tellings at Jonesboro. So I'm looking forward to also hearing Andrew.
Yeah.
Would you like to start us out with a story?
I think so. What a topic you selected. And I agree with Baltimore.
It's a big one.
It is a big one. It is an incredible town. I grew up in Baltimore. I grew up in a neighborhood in Baltimore that was not too far from the water, from the dock area. Of course, that's a number of miles of docks and area for people to pull in with different size boats and stuff like that in downtown Baltimore. The Harbor Tunnel, guess what? The Harbor Tunnel wasn't there when I was a kid.
Oh.
Harbor Tunnel. Well, that's true, too. Harbor Tunnel was being built then, I guess. But the inner harbor area is what I mean. That's the place where everybody goes if they're visiting Baltimore and they want to see something about, they go to the inner harbor. And then they have a really great impression of Baltimore because there's all kind of neat things there and there's stuff and restaurants. When I was a kid, the inner harbor as a place to go to for seeing wonderful things about Baltimore was different. I enjoyed going past the inner harbor on my way to high school. I walked to schools many times. It was about 3 miles from my home to my high school. And every time there was at least one long bus strike where I had to figure out getting rides to school in high school or walk. And I often walked down on the way to my school. I would walk Pratt Street, go through Little Italy and then get Pratt Street, where the boats from the Eastern Shore would come up there early in the morning with all kind of seafood. And these were small boats, not great big boats. These were small boats. I mean, they're probably 25, 30 feet long. And some of them were sail powered, but they had motors also. And they were loaded with seafood. And there would be different ones who specialized, I guess, in different things. You know, oysters, crabs, clams, fish, and also like fruit products, watermelons, you know, different kinds of things that were grown on the Eastern Shore. They packed in the boat, come up. And I can remember walking in the morning on the way to school and seeing the boats, and they were loaded with stuff. And then in the afternoon, coming home from school, when it wasn't soccer season, and so I didn't have practice or something, that those boats mostly would be close to empty and gone. That, you know, if you wanted to get fresh seafood, you could get it on Pratt Street right at the waterfront. But you had to do it pretty early in the day, because by the afternoon, the pickings were slim. And I think that was a great thing for people to be able to go there and shop that way. It was interesting also that part of the harbor right there along Pratt and Light Street, right at that corner, that if you go to the corner of Pratt and Light Street now, you could stand there and you look down the Pratt Street and look down Light Street, and there are places where you can walk off that curb and walk onto businesses, restaurants, and things like that. They filled that in. When I was a kid, even a young teenager, the corner of Pratt and Light Street, there was water. The harbor, the water was all over there. Years later, they filled that in, put buildings there, and you know, the aquarium is along there someplace. But when I was a kid, that was a scary place. I used to go to to Curtis Bay on Monday nights for band practice when I was in the Curtis Bay marching band. And I had to take two buses, and the second bus I took, I would get right near Pratt and Light Street. And when I came home, I would also get the number 10 bus there. Going, I rode the number 10 bus and then the number 6 bus. But coming home, I'd get on number six bus from Curtis Bay. They would drop us at Pratt and Light Street, and I'd wait there for the number 10 bus. Well, we got home, especially in the wintertime, from the band practices, after 9 o'clock. And going to stand on that corner, which was not lighted very well, it was dark, it was creepy looking. There was the harbor right there, you know, and you could easily have stepped over the fence that kept you from diving into the harbor and jumped in if you wanted to. I don't know why anybody would want to do that, because it was pretty filthy, stuff floating in and everything. And one night, a good friend of mine who was in the band, Bobby, he and I we wouldn't stand on that exact corner. We would stand on across Light Street. And across Light Street, there was a honky-tonk. That's what we called it. There was a bar, and there were lots of men and women in that bar. And there was loud music and stuff. And on this one particular evening, we got off the bus, and the bus pulled away, and there was sounds like excitement inside this bar. people were coming out of the doors and stuff. And one guy came and said, "You two kids, you shouldn't be here. What's going on? We get the bus here, mister." He said, "Go across the street and stand over there. Get on the other side of the street. There was somebody that just got killed in here by a knife. And the police are on their way." And then just, you know, we could hear the sirens and everything downtown. Oh, man. So we crossed the street right away and watched. But it was scary. On one corner, the honky-tonk, somebody had been stabbed and had died in there. People were scattering. You know, police showed up. And two young teenagers standing on the next on the other corner. And we hated that corner because it was so dark and where the harbor was and everything. And we used to try to spook each other and say, "Oh, look at that. Did you see that? It was a face came out of the water," stuff like that. You know, when it wasn't quite so dark, if it was like near summertime, when there was still maybe a little bit of light around. But that night was a real scary thing. And at first I thought the man was making fun, you know, just a couple of kids. But that really was what happened. Somebody got stabbed right at the bar and died. And they were having all kind of stuff. So it was very exciting. And that's a short story about the Inner Harbor when it wasn't the place to go for fun.
Wondered where you were going. What a great story. I can just imagine you two guys on the corner, eyes wide.
Oh my goodness.
The sirens screaming up.
Oh boy. Yeah. It was kind of spooky, and that honky tonk, of course, is gone now. That was probably 60 something, close to 70 years ago. I'd say maybe 65, 66 years ago. Yeah.
Boy. Well, Baltimore can be a scary place.
Oh.
Listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stasi Okowski.
Before we move on, I will take with storytelling, I will take this opportunity to talk about Stories in the Round. Our next session is Monday, May 22nd, 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown, 13245 Searfoss Pike, just west of the city limits, Salem Avenue Extended. And we have something really different and special. We have three griots, members of the National Association of Black Storytellers, and a couple of them also members of the brand new Black Storytellers of Western Maryland. And they're coming to Stories in the Round to share the griot storybook that the Griot Circle of Maryland put together a month or two ago. And you can get a copy of the Griot Storybook on Amazon for $25. But if you come to this session on May 22nd, the books will be discounted and you can buy your copy there. The tellers are Patricia Smart, D. Lynn Distance, and grandmother Edna Lawrence Williams. And I'm not sure exactly what they're going to tell. They will probably tell something brief from the storybook. Even I have, I think I have three or four pieces in the storybook. I was just talking to Patricia Smart, who's the editor, about which ones of my pieces made it in there. And she was telling me. I have multiple copies of this book, mind you, in my house, but I've not read the whole thing through yet. I'm working my way through. It's a pretty thick book. And I think they're, something like 40 different griots represented in there. So if you want more information or you want to purchase your tickets in advance, you can call me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638 or contact me via email at Fanitsky, F as in Fanny, A-N as in no, I-T-S-K-Y at hotmail.com. Finitsky at hotmail.com. 301-730-1630. 7 p.m. Monday, May 22nd. $15 at the door, $12 if you get your tickets in advance.
And thank you for that information.
And Stosh will be there too.
Yes. Yes. I'll be smiling at you and taking your money. Or just saying hello.
So I'm going to begin my rambling tour of Baltimore here. Friday, I watched a Zoom session that was presented as a partnership between the Peale Museum and the Baltimore Heritage Area organization. And together, it's called the Baltimore National Heritage Area, excuse me. In partnership with the Peale Center and Museum for Baltimore History and Architecture, presented this one-hour session that I was pretty excited about because I thought it would give me a springboard for the story that I was going to do on Saturday in Baltimore. And so I watched these two presenters, Jackson Gilman Forlini, who's the city's historic preservation officer, works for General Services Administration, managing restoration and renovations of the city's historic buildings, and Matthew Hankins, who's shop supervisor at the Historic Restoration Company, well-known, well-respected, Worcester Eisenbrandt, that has a long history of involvement in restoration projects for the city. Now, I'm told that I will eventually receive a transcript of that full hour program. But today, what I'm working from are the notes I took on Friday and research I did for additional bits of research to fill in gaps or questions that I couldn't pursue with the presenters in the midst of that program. And as you might expect, if you're interested in historic Baltimore, or even contemporary Baltimore, there are many fascinating stories to pursue. Now, the, Gilman Forlini and Hankins build this as a presentation on Baltimore's built environment, which I thought was an interesting vocabulary, addition to my vocabulary, and I wrote that down. There were lots of interesting additions to my vocabulary during that hour presentation. And I started a vocabulary list when I heard that phrase, the built environment. So Gilman Forlini and Hankins distinguished between buildings that the city built that are considered historic because they included design innovations and at some point became emblematic of Baltimore or a neighborhood, at least for a time. That's one reason that the city would work to restore and maintain buildings or the ways that buildings became historic. The other category of historic buildings are those that were not originally intended for municipal use, but that the city acquired in order to preserve some piece of a historic estate. They may have bought parkland that had a mansion on it, or maybe they were seeking to protect an endangered site that has significance for the citizens of Baltimore. And they mentioned other examples of this process or practice from other parts of the country. They mentioned New York State acquiring George Washington's Revolutionary Era headquarters at Newburgh, New York, and the state of Pennsylvania stepping up to preserve Independence Hall in Philadelphia as a national and local symbol of our revolutionary and democratic legacy in this country. And both those acquisitions were fueled by civic pride and then an older idea about preserving old beautiful buildings to inspire and encourage citizen participation, citizen engagement in the community. And while I was listening to all of this, I recognized that there was a connection between the Peale Museum in Baltimore and that act of preservation of Independence Hall in Philadelphia. The two museums, Charles Wilson Peale, the father of the original builder and founder of Baltimore's Peale Museum, moved from Maryland to Philadelphia in the years leading up to the American Revolution, specifically in order to be politically active in the resistance to British tyranny. And I knew about the Peale Museum in Philadelphia, but I didn't know very much about it. So that was one of the things that I researched, was the connection between the two Peale Museums, one in Philadelphia and one in Baltimore. Charles Wilson Peale, the father of Rembrandt Peale, who was responsible for the Baltimore Museum, Charles Wilson Peale started and maintained what he called Peale's Philadelphia Museum in 1784, beginning with a display of 44 portraits of worthy personages of the Revolutionary period. So there's lots of founding fathers there in the Philadelphia Museum. Rembrandt Peale, his son, that Baltimore Museum and Gallery of Fine Arts, as Rembrandt Peale called it, opened in 1814 and included the first complete American mastodon skeleton excavated by Charles Wilson Peale, by his father, who, besides being a well-known and popular painter of portraits, was also a dedicated naturalist and taxidermist, amassing his own very impressive collection of American birds and many, many birds from the British Isles as well, because he traded his preserved animals back and forth across the Atlantic. Now, back to Jackson Gilman Forlini, the manager of the restoration arm of the General Services Department in Baltimore, and Matthew Hankins, the shop supervisor for Worcester. What is that? I've just forgotten the name. Their survey of historic architecture included 13 buildings. Now, I don't think they advertised this Zoom session as including 13 buildings, but as I was keeping notes, I have 13 buildings noted here, and I'm not sure which 13 they thought were the most important or the ones they intended to cover, but they actually spoke about 13 different structures. And I took extensive notes on all of them. Stashi will not be surprised at that. And then I also went in and read on Wikipedia and various local Baltimore sites about these different buildings. But I'm just going to give you the short list right now, because if I tried to talk about every single one of these buildings and tell you the architectural style and the architect and all the dates, we would get nowhere fast. So the one they started with was Mount Clair, which, according to the presenters and the websites that I visited, is the oldest building in Baltimore from the colonial period. And I will only say further that it's a Georgian style mansion, which later had a lot of Federalist additions and features added. I have questions for you, Stash, later on after I do this little recap.
Okay.
Because I don't know the geography of Baltimore very well. So I'm going to ask you to help me situate these different buildings, at least the ones that you know about. The second one they covered is known as the Flag House.
Flag House.
The Flag House, which they named as the place where Mary Pickersfield sewed the first American flag. Now, Betsy Ross is claimed by Philadelphia as making the first stars and stripes for George Washington. But I understand that has been disputed by many people. But Philadelphia will probably never admit to that. They will claim Betsy Ross forever. The Flag House was acquired as a Federalist architectural wonder in 1927 by the city. It was built in 1793. And I saw a picture of it during the Zoom presentation, but I've not don't know anything about it other than that. The third building, the third structure is not really a building, is the Battle Monument in Baltimore. And of course, I drive by that all the time when I go to Baltimore. It's that tall, skinny tower in the middle of the traffic circle if you're going up Charles Street. And it's the first example of municipal monuments in Baltimore, and it appears on Baltimore City flag, and so has a lot of symbolic value to the community. It was built to look at like a tomb. It's this kind of square edifice at the bottom, a shapely squared edifice, but it's very tall, and its style is kind of Egyptian revival. I'm not really familiar with Egyptian revival architecture, but that phrase made sense to me because I know that monument. It has a lotus leaf motif also at the top of the base of the tower. The fourth structure that was mentioned was McKim's Free School, which I had never heard of and was not familiar with at all. It was built as a charitable enterprise by philanthropists to provide free education for the poor. Built in 1833, acquired by the city in 1972, through the efforts of Baltimore's Quaker community. So it was funded, its original construction was funded by the Quaker community, along with a Quaker meeting room, and it was both acquired by the city in the 70s, apparently with some pushback from Mayor Donald Schaefer, and was something of a backroom deal. And these two guys were very circumspect and would not say anything else about how the city came to acquire that building, but that kind of piqued my interest. So I'm gonna do some more research on that myself. And I didn't say at the beginning, but one of the reasons that I was interested in this Zoom meeting is that the story that I wanted to do the next day on Saturday was for the Griot Circle. And I wanted to portray my great-grandfather, Thomas Henry Barnes, T.H. Barnes, visiting Baltimore. Now, my fictional T.H. Barnes visit to Baltimore would have occurred in 1942 at the end of his life. The last trip he might have made at the end of his life. And I wanted to be able to talk about why T.H. Barnes would be excited about traveling to Baltimore and visiting all of these sites. And the two main things that I think he would have been excited about would have been the Pratt Library, the Enoch Pratt Library, where the storytelling event was held on Saturday, because great-grandpa Thomas Henry Barnes was an inveterate collector of books. And of course, he passed on much of that obsession to my father, his grandson, who he helped raise. So I was going to talk about libraries as important in the Barnes Crawford family. And I did that as part of my story and research the Enoch Pratt Library a bit. The other probably big thing for T.H. Barnes would have been the opportunity to walk in Frederick Douglass's footsteps. And so I was interested in those neighborhoods and talking about Frederick Douglass's early life as a older child and very young man in Baltimore. And of course, his escape out of enslavement, out of Baltimore. But there's also this Quaker piece, because T.H. Barnes was educated in a Quaker institution. And I knew that he would have been interested in the McKim Free School as a school that was started by Quakers. And he would have wanted to compare his education to that which was offered at this free school in Baltimore. So I will pursue that research as well. The only other thing that I heard from Hankins and the other guy, Forlini, Gilman Forlini, was the description of the Quaker building as Greek Revival, which reminds me that while I was in Baltimore on Saturday, one of the buildings that I discovered, most to my astonishment, was the First Unitarian Church, which I knew was there, but had never visited. I think I had actually seen it before, but didn't recognize it for the church that it is. And that was also Greek Revival style. So I hope to go back to the First Unitarian Church at some time and admire the architecture as well as attend some services there. It's Doric columns with plinths above the columns, really classical. The fifth site was Clifton Park Valve House, which is part of or similar to a number of different water facilities across Baltimore that the city either built themselves or have acquired in some other way. And right now, the Clifton Park Valve House is a defunct waterworks at Lake Montebello, where the water flows to Lake Clifton, the former reservoir. Well, it did. It's now defunct, but it did at one time feed the reservoir. At a time, it was built at a time when the city had these inspired or aspiring standards for civic beauty and construction. And that architecture, it really is a fine looking building, even though it has a very utilitarian purpose. It's a Gothic Revival building. And I'm familiar with that style and that municipal aspiration because Philadelphia has a lot of buildings like that that are part of the waterworks, and yet they're stunning buildings and you would go to visit them just to see the architecture. Chicago also has some buildings like that, and I can remember driving on State Street and some of the other larger boulevards in Chicago and seeing these tiny little structures that house the infrastructure of the city and wondering, what is that little building all about? So I hope to be able to connect all those things at some point. Clifton Mansion was the sixth building that was discussed. It was built in 1802. It was the former home of Johns Hopkins, and he bequeathed the site for use as a campus for the university, but the university ended up choosing a different site. In fact, the building itself was built in 1804 and the city acquired it in 1894. That's a whole long, complicated story. Beautiful house, not maintained as a house any longer, but has a lot of uses. The seventh building was City Hall, which I have only caught glimpses of in the past. For some reason, I don't travel much on those streets, but when I go to Baltimore, but it is an impressive building, and I am even willing to admit it rivals Philadelphia's City Hall, which is a very similar architectural size, architectural style. Second Empire, which was popular from the mid-1880s to about 1885 or so, distinguished by round windows. And the City Hall was recently renovated. So it's worth going to see, according to these two presenters. The dome at the top is very different from the dome on the City of Philadelphia City Hall, but they both have domes. So it was familiar and interesting to me. The Eastern Avenue pumping station was number eight, and that's another part of the waterworks. Worcester Eisenbrandt, the restoration company that works so closely with the city, they were responsible for the renovation. They did the copper-clad windows, I think they talked about, and referred to a lot of the classical revival details of that building. The War Memorial, which I do not know, was number nine, and it was dedicated to the Marylanders, residents of Maryland, who fell in World War I. But it was eventually expanded to represent the dead and casualties from all of US wars overseas. It was built in 1927 in the neoclassical style. And it's the presenters mentioned the architect Lawrence Hall Fowler, and that this monument is kind of symbolic of government power. It's austere and designed to show the greatness both of the city and the country. The Roland Water Tower, I do not know. I was wondering, Stash, if you knew it. It was built in 1905 to hold water, actually. It does not look like, in the photographs, it doesn't look like a practical shape to hold water. So maybe there's a bit of underground space there too. But built in 1905, became defunct in 1930s, and restoration was completed just 2 years ago on that monument. It did have a utilitarian birth, but it's considered representative of the city since it has this Renaissance revival appearance. Kind of wedding cake tiers that, if I'm remembering correctly, had marble of different colors in layers as it rises pretty high. Then there's the Chick Webb Recreation Center, which is, I guess this is number 11 if you're counting. It was built in 1947. It's reminiscent of a lot of municipal buildings that I know from Chicago and Philadelphia and Baltimore, in that they're kind of monochrome gray concrete and not ornamented. They're kind of a clean, modern style. This particular building, named after the musician, the drummer, and band leader Chick Webb, houses the first swimming pool and recreational center that was open to African Americans. It was an integrated building, but it was the first municipal pool that Black Baltimoreans would have had access to. The Forum Foundation at Dunbar High School in Baltimore is another very modern looking structure built in 1975. It was originally bare concrete in the Brutalist style. That whole idea of something called the Brutalist style was new to me, so I took a lot of notes. But I'll just say that it has been painted. The Forum Fountain at Dunbar High School has been painted in bright, bright colors, yellows and oranges, and I think there's some bright blue on there, because many communities are no longer enthusiastic about those bare concrete structures and wanted something more representative of their own communities. And the last structure that these two presenters mentioned was the National Aquarium in Baltimore. And I have lots of good memories of being at the aquarium. So I was happy they ended on that note. I went with various members of my family to the aquarium at different times since I've moved to Maryland, and enjoyed all of that time. Learned a lot there as well. So I'm going to close there and then hope I get time to come back towards the end of the show and talk about T.H. Barnes's commentary on Baltimore as he might have remembered his visit there.
Okay. Wow. Well, I
didn't
know.
How long was that, Stosh?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Well, I can actually tell you. That was 15 minutes, I believe.
Okay. I think it was a bit longer than that.
Okay.
But, I believe you. I'm sorry. I was using my phone to check on something, and forgot to note the time. So anyway, So I want to talk about a couple of things that I have to do in Baltimore, that I had to do with in Baltimore. There are places in Baltimore that are famous for reasons, like the old Memorial Stadium, which was replaced by the Camden Yards at Oriole Park at Camden Yards. That's the place where the baseball is now played in Baltimore, and that's downtown, closer to the Inner Harbor, of course. And it used to be a train station, Camden Yards. Anyway, I've never been there. I love the old stadium. In 1954, the Baltimore Orioles were born. They had been known as the Browns, the St. Louis Browns. I think it was the St. Louis Browns. Anyway, that professional baseball team, Major League Baseball team, was sold to a Baltimore group, and they renamed it the Baltimore Orioles. And there had been a Baltimore Orioles in the minor leagues, a Baltimore Orioles baseball team in the minor leagues for many, 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 many years. But in 1954, big time Major League Baseball came to Baltimore. I was in the Curtis Bay Band at the time. So was my brother Tony, my older brother. And we marched in the parade that welcomed the Orioles to Memorial Stadium, and they played their very first game that day.
Wow.
Yeah, and I got to march in the parade. I was really thrilled. I was not thrilled with the following fact. I marched in that parade. I carried those dumb cymbals, which were really a pain. And I was glad to do that because I thought I was going to get to go to the game. So guess who got to go to the game? Not Stosh. Tony got to go to the game. My mother determined that I was too young to be going to something like that. I have no idea what she thought was going to happen at a baseball game. But I had to leave the parade. When the parade was over, I had to take a city bus and go back home.
Oh, my.
My brother got to go to the game. And I had a great time. That's one of the places in Baltimore that I remember so well. Because after that, I did go to a number of baseball games. A couple of times we went to Sunday doubleheaders, and they were the best deal in the world. I don't think I'm exaggerating. I think my mother somehow earned $5, and I was able to go to the Baltimore Oriole game up to the old stadium. And I remember meeting baseball players at the end of the game, and even some wives of baseball players who were very nice and very friendly with the young boys that went to this game. We went kind of as a group, neighborhood group. But for $5, we got a ticket into two games, something to drink, and a hot dog. And I can't imagine $5 wouldn't even get a hot dog nowadays, I guess, at a stadium. But and that was great. You know, I remember seeing Connie Johnson, a player for Chicago White Sox, pitch a great game on a Sunday there. Another super duper place that I have great memories of in Baltimore is Fort McHenry. Over the years, Fort McHenry has been nothing. Nobody paid attention to it. It was kind of run down and that. Since my very earliest memory, about maybe I was 6 or 7 at Fort McHenry, I once ran in a race that went through Fort McHenry, one of the first races I ever ran, and I went with a young man from England, David Black, who was a student, an exchange student, and I actually took him from Franklin High School down to Baltimore, and we ran in that race. It was a great experience, and I ran the first mile much faster than I should have, and so I didn't have my best time that day. It was a six-mile race, and at the end of the first mile, I realized that I was running with a bunch of young people, and I had run the first mile in 5 minutes and 50 seconds, which was a pretty fast mile for me and way, way, way shorter in time than it should have been. I paid the price in the last mile. And one other place that I was really fond of was called Federal Hill, down near the Inner Harbor. And actually, you could go to Federal Hill and see lots of neat activities. One of the neat activities that I got the pleasure of being involved in there was I refereed the semifinals of the National Adult Soccer Championship. And this was a championship for grown men playing soccer. And it covered the entire United States. And it was, like neighborhood teams. There were teams from all different places in the States that went into this competition. And I was one of the referees for the team from Philadelphia, who came down to play against the team from Baltimore. And the team from Philadelphia had a professional football player on its roster. He and his brother, both great soccer players. And he actually kicked, I'm not sure, but I think for the New York Giants. This was a long time ago. Anyway, it was a big deal to me because my older brother, Paul, he was 9 years older than I was. He drove from York, Pennsylvania to stand on the sidelines and watch me referee a game. And I was really pleased with that, that he cared enough to drive all that way and stand on the sidelines on a pretty cold day and watch his little brother be a referee. And that was impressive to me because he was my inspiration to play soccer in the first place. And then when I retired from playing to referee. And one last thing about Baltimore places, Patterson Park. That Patterson Park to me was like a safe place for kids to go run, have fun without having to listen to their mother. So, and I spent a lot of time riding my bike to Patterson Park and riding my bike home because my mother had a half an hour gate for me. When I said, I'd like to go out to the park, the guys are playing some ball today. And she'd say, okay, you can go, but be home in a half hour, which drove my friends crazy and drove me crazy. And I got to be really good at leaving the park and getting home just in time and saying, I'm back. Did you need anything? She'd say, no, I'm going back to the park. Okay, come back in a half an hour. And that happened a lot of times. But I spent a lot of time in Patterson Park. And it was a great place. I don't know what it's like nowadays. I think it is it is not as nice. That's what I hear. But I don't go there anymore. So I had lots of adventures in Baltimore. And I don't spend much time in Baltimore anymore because it's a long drive from Martinsburg, West Virginia.
I'm here to tell you that my family reunion was in Patterson Park a couple of years ago, and it was beautiful. We really enjoyed ourselves there.
Wow.
It was a very nice park. Yeah.
And the Pavilion?
Uh-huh. Yep.
Boy.
The only downside was it was really, really, really hot.
Yeah.
I mean, that we were out of the sun, so that was fine. And there was a breeze, but it was pretty toasty.
And when that happened, what did you see, the pagoda?
Well, from a distance.
From this, you know, that pagoda, they have fixed it up nicely now. Last time I was down there, I actually pulled over on Patterson Park, on Patterson Avenue, which is one of the edges of the park, and got out of my car and walked close enough to see it, and it's been fixed up. But when I was a kid, that was like a derelict. It was chain clothes, and there were broken windows, and all that stuff.
And that
does remind me. Can I say one more thing about a memory? All right. Patterson Avenue. Okay. If you went along the park at Patterson Avenue and I think Baltimore Street, right from there was a stop sign, a stoplight. Trucks bringing tomatoes, peaches, and other kinds of food and fruits. Big open trucks with baskets full of these fruits. The ones I'm thinking about, mainly tomatoes. As a kid, this is not something you should ever do if you're any kids listening to this.
No.
from that stoplight, there was a slight uphill, and trucks that were going to go down Patterson Park Avenue all the way to the canning factory, which was about a half mile or maybe three quarters of a mile at the bottom of that street. And it was right on the water. Well, that truck's going up that little incline before they got to another light. And at that second light, once they got past the second light, it was downhill. Well, we sometimes would be sitting on the curb waiting to see if a nice truck would come by with some very nice, juicy tomatoes in baskets. And if we happened to be there at just the right time when the truck came up that incline and got a red light, we would, those of us who were skilled at this, would run to the back of the truck, climb quickly, grab some tomatoes. We never thought they'd get a bag or anything. We just grabbed some out of the basket, stuck them under our shirt or in our shirt or someplace, jump down, and then run into the park. And sometimes we would hear the truck drivers, they would roll down their window and be yelling nasty things to us, you know, but we loved it. And I don't know how many times we did that, at least a few, but I know that I was one of the kids that did that. And it wasn't a good thing to do because it was stealing. However, we figured
taking your life in your hands.
Yeah, and we also figured that they probably lost a lot of the tomatoes in different ways because those baskets were open. I never understood why they weren't covered. But on some of those days, those tomatoes were nice and warm and juicy. I took up all our time.
No, they were great stories. I was not watching the clock at all.
Well, we've been on for like 58 minutes now.
Yeah, we have been. Okay, I'm going to close out. This is Fanny Crawford and...
Josh Ziolkowski.
Your co-hosts for the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. We are independent community radio broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Hagerstown, Maryland, and Martinsburg, West Virginia, offering our listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories.